Welcome to our exciting audio recording with Dr. Ofer Zur, the director of Zur Institute, LLC. I'm your host, Nola Nordmarken, a marriage and family therapist from Southern California, and an author of several courses for the Zur Institute, such as Touch and Psychotherapy, Home Office Practice, and Writing the Professional Will. This audio program is part of an online continuing education course on domestic violence, offered by the Zur Institute, LLC at www.zurinstitute.com. Ofer is a licensed psychologist, fellow of American Psychological Association, instructor, lecturer, ethics consultant, and expert witness in private psychotherapy practice in Sonoma, California. He has been in practice for over 20 years and is director of the Zur Institute, LLC at, again, www.zurinstitute.com, which offers over 120 innovative and challenging online education courses for psychologists, counselors, social workers, nurses, and other mental health practitioners. Dr. Zur is most known for his effort to humanize the field of psychotherapy and counseling, and he is a fierce advocate of appropriate and flexible application of therapeutic boundaries, such as touch, self-disclosure, gifts, etc. Through his writing and teaching, he has asserted that rigid application of risk management protocols is such as no touch, no self-disclosure, etc., can be harmful to clients as well as being unethical. He has dared to challenge certain almost universally unquestioned positions in the psychological community. All this in an attempt to help free us of the constraints of politically correct thinking. That's interesting. To free us of the constraints of politically correct thinking in order to go more deeply into understanding the forces that create our clients' needs and also in order to more adequately address them at multi-levels. So let's start. Ofer, you and I have known each other for at least 12 years. I recall the first course I took from you was on developing a managed care-free fee-for-service practice, and I did just that with great success due to your expert tutelage.
This is, must have been, thank you for a lovely introduction, Nola, and this must have been 20 years ago, if not more.
It was a long time ago, and I did that. I got out of my panels. I started my fee-for-service free of managed care constraints practice and made much more money and worked less and everybody was happier, myself and clients included. But anyway, that's at that particular juncture, you were fighting the tyranny of managed care. You like to have a cause, I know, and you have chosen some very controversial ones. And since I know you and have known you for some time and worked and written with you, I know you to be a deeply and thoughtfully ethical man as a professional and also in my personal encounters with you. I also know that you are no stranger to conflict, that some find your way of presentation to be abrasive, and that you have received a lot of criticism for your stance on certain topics. Some of your earlier controversial ideas have become much more mainstream, as is demonstrated by the APA publishing your book on boundaries in psychotherapy, as well as certain changes, actual changes in ethical codes.
I'm not sure I'll take credit for all of it, but I did put my two cents into helping the field humanize itself.
Wait, how about the sometimes abrasive part?
If you want to change, I forget who said that. If you want to change, you cannot expect people to like you necessarily or to agree with you. So if you want to change, expect conflict. So it's fine with me.
You've been studying enmity, gender relationships and violence and war for a long time. I know you and Sam Keen did a lot of work on enmity and war many years ago. So I know your interest in systems of violence goes way, way back, And I'm curious what initially drew you to this uncharted territory.
Which is, of course, relevant to the topic of today of domestic violence. What originally drew me to the issues of gender and violence system, relationship between men, women, and war. I remember in the 73 war, being in Israel, fighting a war that I'm not sure that I was really all wholeheartedly in it, but regardless, there we were, all these men fighters and ready to die and ready to kill and ready to be killed or ready to be injured. And it was, and the women were in the back, and somehow we were there supposedly to protect our country, to protect our people, to protect our women. But the women have this aura of innocence and aura of goodness and aura of nonviolence and aura of peace, while they, in fact, really were a huge part of the war operation. And often women throughout the history benefited from wars through having slaves work for them, or the resources that came to Rome or to whoever empire that conducted war, including us in the U.S. right now. So I was interested in between kind of what I call the man warrior and between what I called at the time, what some people call the warrior and the beautiful soul. So we are the warriors, we're ready to die, ready to kill, we are all violent, or some of us violent, definitely war is violence, and women, on the other hand, maintain their so-called innocence and peacefulness. And that kind of didn't make sense to me. So I tried to see what is the system between the warrior and the beautiful soul. This is kind of where I came to the field of gender and violence.
And, you know, as I'm hearing you speak, what years are we talking about that you were engaged in that kind of exploration?
This is, I wrote my dissertation on that in 84, so that must have been probably from 79 on, from probably 1980 to 84 was my focus on that, to my dissertation, and thereafter I went and lectured on this topic in Moscow and lecture with Shelley Sklandining and Shepherd Bliss all over. So this is, we're talking about 80s.
So, you know, I think, too, a couple of things came up for me as I heard you talking. One is that Israel has always used and drafted women into their military force. And now I'm fast forwarding to today, to the U.S. and the war we're in right now, and how women are in combat and coming back with PTSD just like the guys. So there have been some really big changes since that.
There have been changes. And I remember when women start coming back in body bags and how upsetting it was for the culture to view women coming back from combat in body bags. Somehow it's expected or normal or okay for men to come back in body bags, but it's not okay for women. When we think about women and violence, which is also relevant to domestic violence, the topic of today, our mothers are women. They give birth to us. They breastfed us. They nurture us. They represent peace and warm and coziness and comfort. And in the 80s, even in Israel, women were not involved in combat with all the mythology of the Israeli soldier. I mean, they were not paratroopers and combat fighters at the time, and not even now. Actually, in the United States, they are to some degree. So I think the world has changed to some degree. We have a new generation that feminism has different mean to them, but still kind of there's a lot of perception about men's violence and women peacefulness. It's kind of still embedded, even though kind of the feminist movement is not, it doesn't have the same kind of say or impact on the younger generation.
It's embedded, but it's loosening up a little bit. And I find it interesting that, of course, I think it's true that the majority of us do feel a little bit differently when a woman comes back in a body bag, but she is out there fighting and coming back in a body bag. And when you relate that to domestic violence, we're now beginning to see some statistics come in about how women are not always the victims. Sometimes men are the victims, but we'll get to that later. Could you describe enmity and how it relates to war, then to gender relationships and violence?
Enmity, kind of in most general way, it's kind of our capacity to abstract and to dehumanize the enemy, so in the other, so we can kill them without guilt. When it comes to war, it goes to back to the system of violence that actually women will support war. This is why my dissertation was this in the same numbers and same ferociousness as men will support war, but for different reasons. So if you ask women about protecting minorities or protecting young children in other cultures, there'll be good justifying for war. Men will go for freedom or for the flag or for more abstract reasons. But then the system of violence is also something that you and I discussed before. The subtitle of my dissertation was at the time, like, what about Sarah? So we talk about war, we talk about domestic violence. When I talk about the role of Sarah in the biblical story, that when God tell Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, I'm adding the child abuse as a system of violence. And the child abuse, actually, it's a more complex in some regards system, because what you have a perpetuator, but let's say the man is a perpetuator of physical or sexual abuse of victim in the system. And what we also have is a woman as a bystander. So the system gets more complex, that the women can often preserve their innocence in a system where men may go to jail, but actually they were the enabler to the system that allow the child to be abused, but they don't get thrown into jail, even though there are laws against a bystander collaboration or allowing crimes to occur. So I always thought, what about Sarah? How come Sarah, and I understand it was patriarchal culture at the time, in biblical time, there in the desert, but how come Sarah didn't kill Abraham when he was ready to kill her long, finally she had a son at age 120 or something. How come she didn't kidnap Isaac and ran? Of course, it wasn't that easy to run in the desert. But nevertheless, it's just a metaphor that we have a system of victim, victimizer, and a bystander. Often the women get designated as an innocent bystander. Of course, in domestic violence, sometimes a bystander is in the entire culture at time. So, and of course, we have children who witnessing it, and it's harmful for them as well. So the systems sometimes can get complex in war, when women in the back line and men in the front, in domestic violence, and it's a dance of violence that we'll talk later on today. And in child abuse, we have an abuser, a victim, and a bystander.
You know, it's interesting how the system contributes to the circle of violence, and the violence contributes to the political and legal structures that are trying to change it but support it. When you speak of systems of violence, now I'm going to quote you here, Ofer. This is a direct Ofer Zur quote. To understand better the dynamic of violent systems, we must first free ourselves from the bonds of politically correct thinking. We must dare to expose the cultural and psychological forces that lead to violence, and to explore the complementary roles that the abuser, abused, and bystander play in such systems. Now, you just addressed some of those issues. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that?
You know, it's this political correctness tied to the issues that are very relevant to domestic violence. It's kind of don't blame the victim. This is probably one of the most profound ingrained that don't blame the victim translates, politically correctness speaking, is don't explore the role of the victim, and in some regards, don't try to help the victim not being victimized again. And by not exploring the role of the victim, we often don't help victims. So we have a culture of victims, and everybody kind of leapfrog over everybody else to be a victim, whether it's a racial victimhood or mental health, or I mean, everybody wants to be a victim. And we have a culture where psychologists and attorneys and the entire culture kind of supporting it, psychologists and psychotherapists and attorneys, of course, making money out of this culture of victim. But what's important is the political correctness that we don't explore the role of the victim. Why did this woman marry a third man who abuses her? Is she really, are we going to help her see her choices? Because sometimes helping her see her choices, people say, oh, you're blaming the victim. And the idea is really not to blame the victim, but the victim mode is very powerful. The victim is not responsible. It's always morally right, politically correctness speaking. It's not accountable for his or her action. It's forever entitled to empathy. And it is kind of justified being having a moral indignation. And there are true victims. There are, you know, young children. We talked about it. Women who are being raped by a stranger are completely innocent victims. There are. Young children would be in the best category for that. They don't have any responsibility. They don't contribute to that. But most victims that we look at as adults, they are not completely innocent victims. But they like the statues because it gives them a sense of goodness. And it's dangerous because some people may die while they don't feel responsibilities. They feel they're morally superior, not accountable, deserve empathy, and they may get hurt again and again and again. But exploring the role, sometimes say, oh, you're blaming the victim. I'm not interested in blame. I'm interested in understanding the role of men in domestic violence, the role of women in domestic violence, in any other violent systems.
Well, I think sometimes with the don't blame the victim approach, it kind of is, the focus is on saying that it's never okay for somebody to commit violence against somebody else. But I can also see that unless there are steps taken to help the victim understand his or her dynamic, perhaps unconscious or subconscious, so that it doesn't continue to occur, it's a rather infantilizing approach and not empowering at all.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of this explore approach of don't blame the victim, don't explore their contribution to the violent system is highly infantilizing. And I've worked with women who were in domestic violence, and I had a case that this woman, it was her four husbands and at least another five long-term relationships, all of them were abusive. And after probably a couple of years of work, she realized that she wouldn't date somebody who wouldn't be hurting her. And we can understand it from her background with her father who was abusive and her stepfather was abusive and her brother was abusive. But she had to take responsibility at some time through her life, if she doesn't want to get hurt again, to making the choice. And of course it's not right for the man to hurt her regardless of anything, and he deserved to go to jail. I have no qualms about it. But sending him to jail doesn't necessarily, or prison, it doesn't help her. In some regard, it may even enhance or increase her sense of victimhood and entitlement as she gets a sympathy without anybody turning to her. I say, you knew he was violent. His former girlfriend ended up in the hospital with broken bones. You knew her. Why did you date him? Why did you marry him? How come you chose to have babies with him? You knew what he did before. You knew he didn't change, he didn't take responsibility. If we're not going to ask her this question to help her understand, she'll end up hurt again. So we need to ask the victims these questions in order for them to stop being victimized.
I've heard, we've all heard a lot about learned helplessness with regard to victim psychology. I read something just recently that somehow I missed before, but it was the term learned hopefulness, and it was related to domestic violence victims. And there's the concept of, well, there's nothing I can do about this. I'm a victim. I'm weak. I don't have any power. But there's a flip side of that that keeps victims stuck in a situation in which they are caught up in learned hopefulness that's distorted, where they believe that somehow they can change the situation. Somehow their abuser will change the situation. The culture will change the situation.
You brought up two different topics. One of them, you're absolutely right. Many women would tell me in the interview or during the clinical work, I knew he was an abuser, but I also thought I'll change him, which is not very uncommon necessarily when women engage in long-term relationship in general, if I can generalize. But then, talking to Lenore Walker recently, Dr. Walker, and her important work, we started with learned helplessness. Now, she for many years now, she has a different look of the learned helplessness, because learned helplessness also implies for her that she can do learned optimism and learn how to help the women to gain control in a way that they feel more responsibility for their action. So it was so wonderful to see Lenore Walker, who burst into the field 30 years ago, taught us about learned helplessness, and later on talked about how this learned helplessness, like Martin Seligman, can be also transformed to learn optimism.
Or the shadow side of the learned hopefulness can be turned into hopefulness that can actually empower and change the system.
And this is what right now kind of Lenore is focusing on, which is really just so important and so heartwarming. And you said it really well.
Okay, so we're going to enter into one of your more controversial formulations here. It's the one in which you place the victim on a five-level scale of responsibility. And before you talk about the five levels, I'd like to say that some see you as blaming the victim. How much are you really talking about blame, and how much are you talking about empowerment and responsibility? And can you kind of integrate that as you take us through the five levels, please?
You know, that's a lot, but let me try to do that. Again, I'm not interested in blame. I'm interested in understanding the nature of the system so we can change it. So I'm the agent of change. And the scale of five that I have developed for victims that have been highly, highly criticized is the first one is, a lot of people agree, it's kind of the non-guilty, innocent victim. This is where children who were sexually or physically abused, rape or murder victims when the crime is unforeseen, unprovoked, and is perpetuated by stranger. Severely mental ill or disturbed adults or children who get hurt or exploited. So we have kind of a long list of truly innocent people. Then come the second category, which is in some regard the most controversial of all. This is with victims who contributed some to their victimization. And for example, will fall into that. This is a woman who had been married five times to five abusers, knew her latest husband, the last husband she married, with whom we were engaged in the individual therapy with her to deal with the domestic violence. She knew he was violent, and she chose to marry him and have babies with him anyway. So she walked into a situation again and again. When I was arrested one time in an African country with a country that didn't have any relationship at the time with Israel, I shouldn't have been there. I took responsibility for being in the wrong place in the wrong time. I was detained for a few days, highly traumatizing situation and upsetting situation, and I take responsibility. For example, we hear about girls in colleges get drunk and then end up having sex with somebody. They are not innocent victims. They drank themselves into oblivion, whatever you call it, and then they end up in somebody's bed. And yes, the man should not have taken responsibility. The men were probably equally drunk. But is she innocent victim? My 16-year-old is already realizing that she is not. He's outraged with that. In his scale, he gives her a 5. He gave her complete responsibility. I'll give her a 2.
You just said, I think the man should not take responsibility. I think you meant he should take responsibility.
Oh, he should. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you for catching it. Of course he's responsible. He's also as drunk as she is, so they're both equally responsible to the drunkenness in some regard. But she's not innocent. The mentality of the Jews in Second World War, the Jewish people in Second World War, how come 5,000 Jewish people could not overcome 50 or 20 SS guards? Israel was born in order never to repeat this kind of victimization. So I come from a culture that doesn't have much tolerance for this kind of victimization. And a lot of people criticize me for this analogy. So from domestic violence to the Jews in Second World War to drunken girls in sorority and fraternity parties in colleges, this is the number 2. Highly, highly controversial. Then we had the share responsibility and number 3. And the best example are alcoholic, kind of it's a system. Young people who play the chicken game, who do gun duels, or kind of a man who go to a prostitute and contract disease. I mean, he's responsible, she's responsible, everybody's responsible, and it's kind of, they can share the responsibility. Number 4 is kind of when the person is more guilty than the person who is being so-called victimized. There'd be the abusive husband and drunk people who harass sober bystander and get hurt, people who choose to go to cult, all kind of people who kind of step into mind fields rather consciously or should have been consciously. And number 5 are the people who are exclusively responsible to the victimization. A robber who break into a house and get shot, or a man who tried to rape a woman and get killed in the action. So there are people who are fully responsible to the action. So again, number 2, the category number 2, the people who should take some responsibility to what happened to them, is the most controversial. And number 2 and 3 are the most applied to our topics at hand of domestic violence.
Okay, here's a question for you. As therapist, do you see us as being in this link of responsibility as bystanders if we do not involve ourselves actively as agents of legal and social change? And if so, where would we be? I'm thinking level 2, level 3?
You know, therapists, sometimes I look at them at level 5 because we make money out of treating victims. We make money out of giving people a PTSD diagnosis, which should be reserved to those who encounter death or near death or fear of death situation, not because somebody has hurt feelings. We give the PTSD right, left, up and down. We go to court and explain the PTSD to jurors and how the hurt feelings. So we are perpetuators of a therapist. Now, I think that many therapists, when they work in domestic violence situation and just only with empathy, without really empowering women primarily, right now I'm talking about, are also guilty of perpetuating a system. Because if you just do empathy, but you don't help her with skills to see it coming, to avoid, to stay in the shelter, not to bail him out of prison, whatever it is, you work with her in a positive way that empowering her, you or therapists can end up being responsible for her later on getting hurt again, because it didn't teach her the skills to see it coming, which may tap into that she's not innocent, but she chose offenders, and help her see it coming so she won't get hurt again. So we are definitely making money out of the victim industry, and we often are, with all our good intentions, are not skilled or not brave or not knowledgeable in really helping victims. When I work with victims on all sorts, I tell them, you are the author of your story. Whether it's a poor Hispanic man, it's an African American who did suffer from racism, LGBT who suffer from discrimination, I help them be empowered rather than just do the ooh and the ah, which is perhaps a good start.
So this is really interesting to me, because not only do we look at the victims on this five level of responsibility, as therapists, we can actually look at ourselves on the five levels of responsibility. We're certainly involved in the system. So, and there are even different categories of that for us as therapists, which may run from 2 to 5, or I don't know. I'm also thinking that the law does not recognize degrees of victimhood and mutual responsibilities. Laws affect public opinion, and public opinion affects laws. So I'm wondering, do you see any movement toward change of this system? And that's actually what I was thinking about when I first asked the question about us as therapists being active agents of legal and social change, actually getting out there and looking at how we might change laws or how we might change social structures.
It varies from court to court, from state to state. Some states just send a man to this domestic violence offender program, the Duluth model that we can talk perhaps later. It does not seem to be highly effective with
can
most.
Can you just stop for a moment and describe that briefly?
The Duluth model is a model where men, it's being treated and needs to admit to their 100% responsibility, and it's based on a lot of ideology, but very little science. It ignores completely other issues of perhaps personality and system approach, and we don't have much evidence that it works. Putting men and forcing them to just admit how bad and how wrong they are, it's a shame-based approach, it's a blame, and it may help very few people. In generally, I don't think we have the data on that. So some states mandate that. Other states are moving in the last 10, 15 years, have been moving to really mandate both men and women to go to do their work, not necessarily together, because sometimes it can be unsafe for the woman to do the work together with a man at the beginning, until it's safe, or sometimes it is safe. You need to know the difference. So some states do mandate the women to go to get some help as well, as much as a man. And then when you talk about the general system, we do see in courts that sometimes jurors need to decide the level of responsibility. So it's not yes, no. They'll say, oh, he's responsible 30%. She's responsible 52%. And I like it because they start thinking about the interaction between them. And it's not always 50-50. But I like when jurors see kind of how much he contributed or she contributed or they contributed. So sometimes we have systems that jurors need to make this decision about how much who contributed to what. And this is, in some regards, more gray area where the complexity and the richness and the truth of the matter often lies rather than the criminal systems that often kind of innocent or victim and then you get a plea bargain of some sort to avoid trials.
Well, and you know, then I can also think in terms of when we define who is the victim and you look at it in terms of systems theory, it's actually both parties that are a victim to the system. But even now, you know, when we're splitting this between men and women, we're really talking gender. We're using that language as we're talking. And I was looking at some statistics from a study that was published in 1998 by the Department of Justice. And they found in terms of reports, 150,000 incidents of intimate violence reported by men as victims versus 840,000 for women. But then an independently funded survey, which was not about who reported it to the law, but what people actually experienced, they found very similar rates of intimate violence. So it gets to be a very complex issue.
I think you're absolutely right that actually it's obvious that women say violence against men is underreported for two main obvious reasons. First of all, women do not have the power to inflict harm, so men will end up in the emergency room. It's one thing. Secondary, men, it's kind of counter to men identity to call the police. And we have known in the past, sometimes when men call police for domestic violence, they'll come and arrest the men.
And or, I think that may be more the case because actually women can harm men. I mean, there are guns, there are knives, there are many different ways that a woman could, I mean, there's the burning bed that's so famous. But women can, but men have a tendency not to report because they might be labeled wimpy, and that's something that goes way back in male socialization, at least.
Exactly. And the police sometimes will not take it very seriously, and if she complains and he complains, he will end up being arrested. But let's talk about the burning bed syndrome, the movie. There is a myth that women who end up killing their husbands do it primarily or almost exclusively in self-defense. So this is actually something that's relatively easy to study. And people went to prisons and studied women who killed their men. And what they found out that majority of them in one study of Dr. Mann, M-A-N-N, and When Women Kill, this is his book, back in 1996, he says that almost 80% of the women in his study had prior arrest record. And more than half of them has a documented history of violent offenses prior to killing their husbands. So the burning bed, there are women who kill the man in self-defense. There is no doubt about it. But what we find out, that the majority of them actually have a long history of violent offenses in teenager and thereafter. So the Burning Bad is applied to some women in some situations, but it's not the majority of women who do things in self-defense. But sometimes they do. And I know Lenore Walker is highly involved in these cases where the women do kill the men in self-defense, and she can explain it, and she does fantastic work. But this is a woman that she defend are not necessarily the majority of women who end up killing the husbands. But we have this, again, this intrinsic, back to kind of my psychology of war and gender studies, that we have this instinctual, women are nurturers, they give birth to us, they breastfeed us, they feed us, they change us, they raise us. We have this kind of idealization of the feminine, and the violence view of male, which is traditionally has been the warrior, so this split, it does not hold. The research does not hold. Another statistics that may help us when we are looking at the LGBT community in lesbian relationships, for example, you think, In the old model of women peacefulness and men as violent views, that lesbian relationship will be domestic violence or intimate partner violence free. And the fact is, sad fact or revealing fact or telling fact is that the statistics of intimate partner violence among lesbian women is very comparable to the general population, to the heterosexual population.
You know, it's so interesting. Before we started talking today, I was going to ask you, if a woman presents to you that she has been abused, how do you treat it? And now I'm thinking more in terms of being aware of my own split with that. And I'm actually kind of moving more into thinking of it as batterer and battered rather than gender-oriented. So if a person presents to you that he or she has been abused, how do you treat it?
I look for the system. I look for how did it evolve? Violence does not happen because, let's say, most violence doesn't happen unexpectedly. There was a whole bunch of things that led to that. And sometimes it may be that he is just drinking and violent and anything can provoke him. So sometimes it's not really a clear system right there at dinner table. But the question still, why did she marry him? Why did she stay with him? At this day and age, it's a little bit easier to leave because women economically is not where women used to be 50, 60 years ago. Shelters are available everywhere. Police are highly trained, thanks again to Dr. Walker. Police are trained all over in the Western world how to treat domestic violence and how to help disengage and protect women primarily from getting physically hurt. So when I'm presented with a domestic violent situation with a person, I'll try to get the story. How did it evolve? Did you see it when you start dating? What is a pattern? How do you contribute to the pattern? There was a few cases that I have worked with couples, and it was safe enough to work with couples because there was no imminent violence, and sometimes it's not safe. We need to be very careful when we work with couples in domestic violence that it is safe for her primarily.
And also the therapist?
The therapist, I'm not sure, but probably, yeah. I guess as a man, I didn't think about it hard enough, but probably for a woman therapist as well. And so what we find out, and there's some statistics on that women get hurt in two places around the house in more frequency than in other places. This is when is the inside door from the bedroom, when the man tried to leave and she continued to talk to him and to harass him and to demean him. And she wouldn't let him leave because women are getting anxious if the connection is disrupted, and sometimes they prefer to get hit but maintain the connection. The other place where women get hit in higher frequency is the when the door to the outside, the inside of the outside door, that when men try to leave the apartment or to leave the home, and women are getting highly anxious at this point, whether they're abusive or not, they won't let him leave, and they end up with a black eye. So this is the two places. Men often get hit in the kitchen with a kitchen knife and other places, but women often in the house get hit in these two places. And this is, shows you it's a matter of system. One time I worked with a man where the woman would not let him leave the house because she was standing in the door, and he'll have to hurt her in order to get her out of his way. That he took the screen out. Thank God it was a one-story house. He took the screen out and left the windows unlatched so he can just hop out of a window when he needed to leave. And it worked. And in this case, I mean, she felt abandoned and she upped the ante, and it was very complex system, because once he's kind of disengaging, she gets even more anxious and potentially even more abusive verbally in this regard. So back to your question, when I work with victims of domestic violence, men or women, because both of them are victims in some regard, is I work to try to understand the system between them. What led to that? What is her history? What is his history? But how does it reenact it in the family? And this is what I focus, because it's a thing. This is what can really help. And I don't need both of them to work with the system. I can have one person and to intervene systemically, as you know, as a family therapist.
But when possible, how great to have both. And so, just to summarize what you're saying, you're encouraging practitioners to help their domestic violence clients, both the batterer and the battered, to move out of full victim or perpetrator mentality, kind of into understanding the systems that brought them into this circle, and achieve some responsibility and empowerment to change.
That's better than I could say. Yeah. The only person that each of them can change is themselves. So the system will change as they change. But as we know, systems, as an MFT, experienced MFT, you know it better than me, that systems are resistant to change. So if he stops bothering, she may increase the abuse. If she kind of stops the verbal abuse, whatever she does, he may increase his violence. So we need to tolerate an area and make sure that people are safe. This is where the shelters are coming into the picture, or a safe place for her to go with the children, or for him to go with the children. Again, because we know that actually women violence is less reported, but more prominent. For example, there's many, many more women who hurt their children than men. And you can explain it because women spend much more time with children. So the myth of women peacefulness and innocence does not hold at all, and when we really look at the reality, and when therapists lose track of that, they are really perpetuating violence by inaction and by becoming part of the enabling system rather than the true helping. Now, not everybody is receptive to my approach. I send them to my online page to read my piece on victims, and many of them read the piece on victims and don't like it. They don't like to hear the interviews. I'll put this interview online as well. They don't like it, and they never come back. And I can't do anything with that. But I do tell them my approach ahead of time, and I really make it as a homework almost for them to read some of my stuff, so they know my attitude towards violence, that violence is systemic. Violence is not just a biologically male problem.
And I know that not every couple is ready to go into therapy together, and some need different stages or groups in order to get there. But personally, as a therapist, I love working with couples together, because once they understand the system that they've been stuck in, they can join together to address the system and there's much less individual defense that goes into that.
Again, we need to, as you know well, probably work with more couples than I did. We must, when we talk about a couple work with domestic violence, we must emphasize the issue of safety primarily for the woman.
Yes.
And it's only can be conducted when there is no evident kind of danger. And because I'm in private practice and the style of my private practice and the people attract to me, usually I do get people that are not on the way to the ER, not on the way to report to the police. It's contained and nobody is in physical danger. But you may be working a little bit more in the trenches than me, and this has to be, and most therapists working with couples need to really make safety assessment before the work with key people, because some things can come in therapy that can enrage the man and
yes.
or feel humiliated, which can put her and her children in harm's way, and we need to see it coming as much as possible.
Yes, and I don't work in the trenches. My population is probably a lot more like yours. Ofer, I see we're running out of time here. And we've covered a lot of territory here today. I wonder, is there anything else you would like to say?
We did cover a lot. I have more stuff online, more interviews, more specific kind of articles about the culture of victims, and if people want to follow up with that. This course of domestic violence will cover many, many areas that will be added to this section. But what's important for me is that we need to move from blame to understanding how a violent system hurt people, children, women, men, elderly, young, lesbians, gay, transvestites, mentally ill. So if we look at the system and help adults who are capable to make consent and to make informed decision and to change their behavior, to see how they contribute to that. Empathy can go just only that long. Not, and watch out with our PTSD diagnosis, with it's really just given when people facing or think they're facing life-threatening situation, not because they just had hurt feeling or saw traumatic events of 9/11 on television from the West Coast. That does not constitute PTSD, regardless of what the response is. And so not to overdiagnose a PTSD, to move from blame and to understand that we can intervene systematically, and this is the things that give us more hope. Sending him to prison may be a good idea, but my sense is it may not help her on the long run.
When I think about the PTSD diagnosis and how, in my opinion, it's overused a lot, I actually think that in the field of domestic violence, if you look at that criteria of the person is experiencing a life-threatening situation, that probably happens a lot.
Oh, that would be valid. Absolutely. If somebody is facing life-threatening situation in domestic violence, this will constitute legitimate PTSD. Absolutely. I agree with you. But again, we give the diagnosis because often very loosely and because we get reimbursed. And this is how we, a therapist, are becoming part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And sometimes PTSD and victimization go together while they are really true PTSD. Then we need to remember, once we talk about PTSD, that not every traumatic event leads to PTSD. I was in war. I got shot at. I definitely faced death. And I did not end up, it was highly traumatizing. It was very upsetting. But I did not become, quote, mentally ill with a DSM diagnosis for PTSD. I tried to make meaning out of it. And this is all the years since 1973, I've been working on it on and off. And here I'm talking to you about how I made meaning out of my a traumatic experience without suffering PTSD. So we don't want to equate traumatic near-death or a dangerous experience with PTSD. PTSD has to do how you respond to this extremely traumatic experiences.
And I think that all of that applies to the whole domestic violence scene that we're looking at. And there's that whole resilience factor, too, that I know requires more study and has had a lot of study. And how do you see that being integrated into treatment with DV victims?
You know, the resilience thing are just so wonderful because we see people who has gone through incredible traumatic experiences and came out shining, and who are the people who, and some of it is really personality and genetic, that people just got blessing with incredible gene for resilience. But then we can teach, we can educate, we can mentor, we can use therapy to increase resilience as well. So I think this is kind of, sometimes when I work with veterans, for example, I tell them my war story and I teach them how you can treat it with resilience rather than being a victim of what happened to you. Of course, Viktor Frankl, and he's making meaning out of his Holocaust experience as a young man, is the ultimate resilience in some regard. And we have many kind of people like him. So we can also, it's a beautiful point that you put up, we can bring resilience, which will be another kind of anti-victim approach.
And very empowering. And I love to just think about how, as those of us who are trying to help move forward, that it's helping to affect future generations.
It is, because this is what, if we stop the domestic violence, not just by sending him to jail because she may go and find another abuser, but by working with her and with him, regardless of where they stay together, we can teach the next generation a different way of loving and safety within the family system.
What a pleasure to speak to you today, Dr. Zur.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you again. And I really appreciate you kind of confronting this difficult questions with so much bravery and integrity.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.